So the passage this morning is from Matthew 16, from verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Jeanette, for reading us that passage. Thanks so much, Lucy, for leading us through worship. And just while I sort myself out, you could be forgiven for thinking at this point, after that reading, and then thinking about the great humanitarian need that we know about in Turkey and Syria, and then seeing the church treasurer getting up to preach, you could be forgiven for thinking that you're about to get a major guilt trip as you're challenged to give more money. Well, you're not. Don't worry. Also, don't worry about that. Right, okay, I've got my notes. I'm not going to talk to you about your giving. I mean, it is true that Jesus has plenty to say about giving against a background, as you may have spotted earlier on in that chapter that Jeanette read to, against a background of an underlying assumption that you will be giving. The chapter starts with Jesus saying, when you give, this is to be your attitude of heart. So Jesus thinks you will be giving, but that's not what I'm talking to you about. If that's what the Holy Spirit chooses to challenge you on, far be it from me to stand in his way, but it's not what I'm going to be talking to you about. Throughout this series that we're currently looking at about transformation, we're looking at how we can become like Jesus, not by doing all the good things, but by being changed into the type of people who just by nature will do good. And that's a change that takes place in the heart, not in my actions. It should give rise to a change in actions, but fundamentally it's a change in the heart. So it makes me realize that I'm not up to this job. I cannot change your heart. Whatever words I speak, however persuasive or otherwise they are, I cannot change your heart. But I know someone who can. Let's talk to him right now. Father, I feel a bit daunted, really, because I can't do anything here to change anyone's hearts, least of all my own. Lord, will you come and change our hearts? That seems like an enormous thing to ask. And yet, we're kind of pushing at an open door here because it's what you want to do. It's your desire for us that you will transform us from the inside out to be like the wonderful Lord Jesus. That is our desire, Lord. It's our desire as we worship you this morning. It's our desire that we know your presence with us, and we know you alongside us, and we know you stepping into our lives. And it's your desire now as we listen to your word that you, through my faltering and imperfect words, will somehow do an amazing thing in our hearts. Twice this morning, in the space of just a couple of minutes before the service began, two different individuals said to me about when Jesus fed the 5,000, and it started with this little boy just saying, "Look, I've got this, these loaves and these fishes. Can you do anything with them? Lord, will you take my loaves and fishes right now and do something amazing with them? To me, the bread seems a bit stale and the fish looks a bit off, but you can do amazing things, Lord, and I pray that you will do that this morning." Amen. My title this morning is Transformation Through Simplicity. Is that what it says up there as well? Well, that's good. That's a relief. Transformation Through Simplicity. Like any good preacher, I kind of thought, well, I've got a word there, simplicity. I better check what the Bible has to say about it. So I got out my concordance and looked up the word simplicity. Got this big, thick, chunky, good old-fashioned, exhaustive concordance. What that means is that it guarantees to tell me every occurrence of a word, wherever it might be in the Bible. Great. So I looked up simplicity, and you know what I found? Nothing. Great. Good start. Ha! Not to be daunted, I thought, let's try looking up simple. Ah, did better there. The word simple appears quite a lot, mostly in the book of Proverbs, and mostly signifying lacking wisdom. And it is never once commended as being a good thing. Right. Where does that leave me? So I then started thinking, well, let's go and find what other people then might say about simplicity. So I found a few quotes. And thankfully, bearing in mind the way that Proverbs treats the idea of simplicity, thankfully I found some very wise, knowledgeable and clever people who had some good things to say about simplicity. Let me read some to you. Isaac Newton, he was quite a smart guy. He invented gravity, didn't he? He said, "Truth is to be found in simplicity." Oh, I like that. "And not the multiplicity and confusion of things." Oh, yeah, okay, go with that. If you don't like the scientific approach that you get from Isaac Newton, how about a literature approach? Leo Tolstoy: "There is no greatness where there is no simplicity, goodness, and truth." Oh, yeah, that's okay. How about Leonardo da Vinci? Oh, yeah, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication," he said. Or how about a quote from a philosopher, Confucius? He said, "Life is really simple, but we insist on making it complicated." So you begin to get this idea that maybe simplicity is quite a good thing. It's associated with things like truth, and goodness, greatness, sophistication. And you might think, great, yeah, I want some of that. But what's this got to do with Jesus? What's this got to do with being transformed into the likeness of Jesus? Why on earth am I preaching from the words of Confucius? Don't worry, I'm not. In recent years, a few kind of Christian authors, pastors, teachers have said a lot about simplicity as a lifestyle choice for the Christian. Joshua Becker, who's an American author and pastor, says this: "Simplicity is the intentional promotion of the things we most value." Hang on to that. The things we most value. "And the removal of everything that distracts us from them." So the question behind everything that I say this morning is, what do you most value? Because simplicity means about a single-minded focus on those things and removal of all the distractions. Richard Foster, who's been quoted quite a few times in this place over the last term and a half, Richard Foster says, simplicity is an inward reality, it's a change of heart, that can be seen in an outward lifestyle. Okay, so that's what we're talking about when we're thinking about simplicity. Jesus actually, although he never uses the word, addresses this question of what matters most, probably more than just about anything else in his followers' lives. What matters most? And in particular, he talks a lot about this mindset in relation to possessions. It has been said, I'm not sure, I tried to count it up for myself and work it out how this could be true, maybe near enough, but it has been said that 25% of the Sermon on the Mount directly addresses the issue of possessions and our attitude towards them. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's 23%, I don't know, how do you measure these things? So it's probably worth looking at. Transformation through simplicity. In the passage that Jeanette read to us, we see quite clearly two opposing calls to us. And it raises the question, which call do we listen to? It presents to us two paths to contentment. One of which looks good, but doesn't work. And the other one looks tough, but does work. See if you can work out which is which as we go through. First of all, there's the call of the world. We'll look at that. And then we'll look at the opposing call, which is the call of Jesus. And then I'll ask you the question, which call is dominant in your life? Okay? The call of the world. Well, we saw it in Jesus' opening line in the passage that was read to us. He talks about laying up treasures on earth. Okay, he says, do not lay up for yourselves, but that is the call of the world is lay up treasures on earth. And you hear this call and you see this call every time you turn on your TV or read a magazine or see an advert on the side of a bus or at a bus stop or in a shop window. You see this call all around you. The call of the world is get stuff. Because it's only by getting stuff that you can find value in yourself. It's only by getting stuff that you can find true security, that you can find true fulfillment in life. It's about the accumulation of stuff. That's what gives me meaning and identity in life. What designer brands am I wearing? What phone am I using? It's all about stuff. And it's only by accumulating stuff or the money that enables me to buy stuff that I can really know contentment, so says the world. Somebody once said, civilization is the limitless multiplication of unnecessary necessities. I like that, unnecessary necessities. The things that we think we absolutely must have, most of them are probably not that necessary. But we've been conditioned into thinking, I have to have it, I have to have it. Whether it's my car, my phone, my TV, my computer, my laptop, my tablet, my, I must have it. Has anybody got any idea who said about the limitless multiplication of unnecessary necessities? I'll tell you. It was Mark Twain. Okay, he was always pretty good for a quote. He said that before the invention of electricity, running water, the telephone, the motor car, TV. Hang on a minute, aren't these essentials in life? Mark Twain was talking before they were invented, saying, look at us, we're just accumulating all this stuff that we don't really need. What would he think if he saw us now? Ooh. He would say, I told you so. Richard Foster, again, I'll mention him again, he says that our culture conditions us into this insane attachment to things. I must have things. And now you're hopefully thinking, no, that's not me. Okay. I wonder, if you're going away, or maybe if you're just going out for the day, and you walk out the front door and you shut the front door behind you and you start to walk off, and you think, oh no, I've forgotten my... Got to go back. Most likely your phone, which you may have no need to use of that day, but you can't possibly go out without it. You've got this attachment to it, what Richard Foster calls an insane attachment to things. If you've been away for a few days, maybe, or been away on holiday, and as you're heading for home, just on the final leg of the journey home, and you start to think about being home. You put out of your mind the fact that, you know, you've got to do the washing and unpacking and everything, and you start to think, I'll let you into a secret. I start thinking, I'm going to be back in my armchair. My armchair. For all that I might have enjoyed the week away or whatever, my armchair is what it's all about. I have this insane attachment. And all the better if I then get home and grind up some fresh coffee and I'm sitting in my armchair drinking freshly ground made coffee. You're attached to things? How does your day pan out when it starts with some disastrous thing like dropping your favourite mug? When somebody asks you later in the day, how's your day going? The first thing you say, oh, dreadful, I dropped my mug this morning. I'm attached to this thing. How does your day pan out when, driving to work, your car develops this strange knocking noise? Someone asks you how your day's going. Oh, it's dreadful. I think it's something wrong with my car. Attachment to things. How do you feel when your Amazon delivery arrives and you unwrap it and you take out of the box this brand new shiny phone? An insane attachment to things. What do you do with the stuff that you've accumulated that you think, you know, I don't really like that anymore. I don't want it anymore. It's no value to me anymore. But maybe if I could sell it on eBay, I can get a bit of money, then I can buy more stuff. An insane attachment to things. What Jesus calls laying up treasures on earth. Interestingly, he says two other words in there as well, which I missed out. He says, lay up for yourselves. We're not even thinking about, you know, sort of making sure that you've got enough money to feed your family or to pay the bills. It's laying up for yourselves. It's this selfish, I must have, I must have, I must have, I must have, I need, I need, I need. John Rockefeller, the world's first billionaire, made his fortune in oil, was once asked the question, how much money is enough? And his answer, just a little bit more. He had everything. He knew that his heart was telling him he wanted just a bit more. If I could just have that little bit more, I would be content. I would be satisfied. It doesn't work. It leads to frustration because you can't have that thing that you want. It leads to an unhealthy comparison with others because he's got that and I can't afford it. It leads to a dissatisfaction, and it leads to this endless chasing after something you can't have. There was a very wise man who lived many years ago who had everything, absolutely everything. His name was Solomon. He was the king of Israel. He was wealthy beyond measure. He was wise beyond measure. And he said this in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Oh, bit of a blow, isn't it? Well, I suppose John Rockefeller showed that as well. Just need a little bit more. What the world has succeeded in doing is tuning us into this idea of psychological obsolescence. What do I mean by this? We're familiar with the idea of planned obsolescence. You know, manufacturers who deliberately build a feature into their product so that in a couple of years' time that product is kind of obsolete and you need another one, need a replacement. But we've now got this thing called psychological obsolescence, which means that a year or so after getting a product, you feel ashamed of it. You feel that you must have the newest version. The masters of this, Apple and the iPhone. I am, I don't know, ashamed or proud to say I've never owned an iPhone. I understand that the iPhone 13 was an exceptionally good phone. Because for a while I was tempted to get one, but thought, no, I don't want an iPhone, The iPhone 13 was a very good phone until last year. The iPhone 14 came out, and then suddenly the iPhone 13, wouldn't want one of them, wouldn't be seen dead with one of them. Has anybody got one? Have you got an iPhone 14? No, you've got to have the iPhone 14, but hang on a minute, though. Before you buy it, you do realize there is also the iPhone 14 Pro. So you wouldn't want just the iPhone 14, would you? Because you can get the iPhone 14 Pro now. And imagine the shame of pulling out your iPhone 14 and the person next to you has got the Pro version. Oh, no! How embarrassing. Well, hold off a bit longer because there is a rumour that the iPhone 14 Pro Max is coming soon. Just in time for later this year, the iPhone 15 being released. And guess what happens then? iPhone 14 Pro Max. Oh, come on. We are conditioned into this feeling of shame and dissatisfaction with the stuff that we have. That's the call of the world. Get more stuff and realize it does nothing for you. Jesus puts it quite clearly, really. A few things that he says about stuff. We saw one of them in our reading. It doesn't last. Moth and rust or the next version destroys it. Thieves break in and steal. What you thought was so valuable, you realize is worth nothing. He says later in the same chapter, in chapter 6, verse 31, he says, Don't be anxious saying, what should we eat or what should we drink or what should we wear? Jesus says stuff just makes you anxious. It just adds more to the anxiety. Have I got the right stuff? Is my stuff still going to be working tomorrow? Is that noise that the car's developed meaning that it's not going to work tomorrow? Oh, I'm so anxious about it. What about when the bill comes in for your mobile phone contract and it's gone up and oh, I don't know, what am I going to do now? I've got to pay it because I can't be without it. It's just making you anxious. What else does stuff do? Remember the parable of the sower when Jesus talks about the man who went out to sow the seed and the seed fell in various places? Some of the seed fell among thorns, and Jesus explains that the thorns it represents the people where the seed has been sown and it's sprung up, but he says the thorns are like stuff. He says the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things enter in and choke the word. What a tragedy, eh? You receive the word of God, you welcome it, you say, yes, that's the way to live. And then the desires for other things choke that word, and here's the killer, and it proves unfruitful. This whole year in our church, we're thinking about living the abundant life that Jesus gives, which is a life of bearing fruit. And what Jesus himself tells us is get too hung up on stuff, and all the good preaching that you hear and all the good practices that you're learning and taking on and saying yes, they just count for nothing. They get choked because of stuff. Doesn't sound like a good deal, does it, really? And then, to top it off, there's something else Jesus says. This is in Luke chapter 12. He says, take care and be on your guard. Be on your guard. I mean, that's pretty strong. Against what? Against covetousness. Did I say that right? Covetousness, that's it. Coveting, wanting stuff that I can't have. Jesus says, take care and be on your guard against that. Why? Because your life does not consist in stuff. Well, he puts it a bit more eloquently. He says, life does not consist in the abundance of one's possessions. All it does is to make you open to attack. Satan will use it and he will get in and he will make you unfruitful. Is that what you want? Say no. What is the call of Jesus then? Well, he says it in the very same verse when he says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. He says, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Ah, okay. Hang on, you say, what does that mean? What does it mean to lay up treasures in heaven? Does it mean, does it mean just giving loads of money to the church? I shouldn't say this, but no, it doesn't. It might do. There are a couple of examples where Jesus did actually explain exactly to people what it meant and how they were to lay up treasures in heaven. I'll read them to you. One of them was the rich young ruler who came to him and said, how can I be right with God? How can I get eternal life? And Jesus said, if you would be perfect, go, sell what you possess, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Okay, so in that case, there was another case where now he was speaking to his own followers, people who were already following him, and he said to them in Luke 12, sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old and with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail. So there were cases where Jesus said, give it all away, and in that way you'll get treasures in heaven. But, as I said at the beginning, this is not about a guilt trip, and it's not about imposing on you patterns of behavior to try and make something happen. What Jesus saw in those two cases was that individual hearts were saying, I want to hold on to this stuff. And he had to take the nuclear option with them and say, get rid of it. Just get rid of it now, because it's standing in the way. It was not a universal call to everyone who followed after Jesus. And there are plenty of cases of Jesus welcoming wealthy, rich people into his family. But there's no question that Jesus kind of declared war on the materialism of his day, because he saw what it did to people's hearts. And so in the reading that we had read earlier, he says at the end of it, you cannot serve both God and money. Stuff is like a rival God you choose. Do you serve the one true God, or do you serve this God called money, or the older translations call it mammon, which is like pulling a word from the Aramaic to give it a name that effectively Jesus is saying, look, you've made it a god, so much so that I'm giving this god a name which you wouldn't normally use in your everyday language. Mammon implies just stuff that you want to accumulate for yourself. A rival God, you can't serve both. And Jesus modeled this in his own life. Right from the beginning, do you remember Satan said to him, look, I will offer you everything, the whole world and everything in it, and all you need to do is to bow down and worship me. Jesus says you can't serve both God and mammon. And so he said to Satan, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. No question in Jesus' mind that to serve God and his purposes and his Father's will, he couldn't chase after stuff. Jesus modeled contentment in his life. I can't really say that Jesus modeled simplicity, because life generally was simpler in his time. And so, you know, to say, well, Jesus went around in sandals and he walked everywhere, but so did everyone. So let's not read too much into that, but look at the contentment that he did show. He chose, I know he was only a baby at the time, but he chose from the beginning of time that when he came to earth, he would be born in a stable and laid in a manger. He had other options, and he chose to start off in that way. He chose to make his grand entry into Jerusalem on a donkey. He could have chosen an amazing white charger and sort of coming in with fanfare. He chose a donkey. Jesus was comfortable going to the home of a rich person and sharing a meal. He was comfortable with going to the home of a poor person. It didn't bother him. He wasn't influenced by that. Yeah, Jesus demonstrated contentment. He wasn't against being rich. He wasn't against comfort. He wasn't against pleasure. Some of Jesus' critics called him a glutton and drunkard, and he seemed quite happy to wear that badge. I love the idea that when Jesus was invited to a wedding where the wine ran out, he could have said, well, don't you think you've had enough already? I know plenty of Christians who would take that line and try and suck the joy out of a situation. Jesus said, okay, I'll give you some wine. Some wine. 150 gallons of the stuff. I make that about 900 bottles. Now, I don't know how many people were at this wedding, but 900 bottles of the best wine seems incredibly extravagant when, as the master of the feast said, everybody's already had enough. 900 bottles of the best wine. Jesus was not against us enjoying stuff, but, he says, understand there is a tension here. Paul puts it very well when he writes to Timothy. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, he says this, God richly provides us with everything to enjoy. But just a few verses earlier, he has said in verse 10, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Get that? Get that tension there? One of them seems to say, yeah, take it all in, enjoy it. And the other one says, just watch it. Just be careful. Jesus was totally at ease with that tension. He could enjoy, but he could warn, and he understood, and he knew what God's desire for him was, and that's the path that he followed. For Jesus, simplicity meant this grateful, happy enjoyment of the situation of his life. That's really what contentment is about, isn't it? It's about taking hold of what matters most. Remember that line from the beginning? What matters? What's the main thing in your life? And it's about valuing that above all things, recognizing that life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. The value of your life is based on what's in your heart. It means that those things that you want, those unfulfilled desires, don't actually affect your happiness. Don't judge me on this, but through most of my life, I've always had this desire, this thought that one day I would own a Jaguar. At various stages of my life, it's been different models. I mean, an E-Type would be nice, but, you know, at various stages of my life, I've thought, yeah, well, you know, an XJ6 would be okay, an XJ6. Yeah, I'm not too fussy, but I've always had this desire that one day I would own a Jaguar. I think I've got to the stage now where I've realized this is not going to happen. Contentment means that's okay. I'm happy with that. It would have been good, but equally, it's good not to. And they only break down anyway, don't they? And don't moth and rust corrupt and all that, especially with them. Yeah, it's okay. Unfulfilled desires don't need to curb my happiness if I'm living in contentment. Our friend Richard Foster describes contentment, and in fact describes Jesus' life in this way. A joyful life of carefree unconcern for possessions. They don't bother me. Stuff does not bother me. And so Jesus says, give to everyone who asks from you. And from the one who takes away your goods, don't demand them back. Just let them go. It's just stuff. It's just stuff. You don't need it. You never did. Let it go. I may have possessions, but they don't need to have me. Get that? I possess them. They don't need to possess me. Hebrews 13, verse 5 says, keep your life free from the love of money. Just don't let it control you. Don't let it master you. Keep your life free and be content with what you have. For he has said, God has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So why on earth would I be hanging on to this like my life depended on it? And Jesus says, keep your life free. God has said, I will never leave you. There's a lovely little snapshot of life in the early church. We see it in Acts chapter 2. we see it in Acts chapter 2. We also see it in Acts chapter 4. And just let me read to you a few verses from Acts chapter 4. It says this: the full number of those who believed were of one heart and soul. And this is the important bit. No one said that any of the things that belonged to him was his own, but they had everything in common. Now, this is not necessarily a prescription for modern church life. So don't worry, I'm not asking you just to kind of pool your resources now and say, right, we'll all share everything. In fact, you know, within just a few chapters of that verse in Acts, already we see that that's not the expectation for the church. People had their own homes because the church was meeting in them. People were wealthy and their wealth was being used in the church, but also for their own comfort. So it's not necessarily a prescription for our life, but it is a natural outworking, or it certainly was a natural outworking for those early disciples. They'd spent time with Jesus. They'd seen how Jesus lived his life. They thought, how can we do that? I know none of my possessions are my own. Contentment. The Apostle Paul says a few things about contentment, quite well-known verses. I'll just read them to you, and I do realize I need to crack on here. Paul says in Philippians 4, I'm not speaking of being in need, for I have learned, in whatever situation I am, to be content. Well, it's easy if you've got everything, isn't it? But Paul goes on, I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. And he says, in all those situations, I've learned to be content, because he says, it's tough, but he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. I read earlier from 1 Timothy, there is great gain, says Paul, in godliness with contentment. We brought nothing into the world, we can't take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. Contentment is a call from Jesus, it's a call from the apostles, and Paul gives us a good reason for it. Again, in 1 Timothy 6, he's giving instructions for those who are rich. Now, however you may feel about your bank balance and all the rest of it, by the standards that Paul was speaking of, you are rich. Okay. If you've seen news reports, which I'm sure you have, from Turkey and Syria recently, of people who have lost everything, you are rich. Paul gives them a warning. He says, don't set your hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. And then he goes on, this way you're storing up treasure for yourselves as a good foundation, so real treasure, so that, he says, so that you may take hold of that which is truly life. Remember our theme for the year, abundant life. You want abundant life? Paul says, well, don't lay up treasures on earth then. Be content, and that way you'll get an abundant life. Okay, we have the call of the world, we have the call of Jesus. Which call is dominant in your life? Jesus gives us three simple tests, and we heard them in the reading that we had earlier. The first is, look at your heart. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be. So, where is your treasure? Where is your heart? What is it that has a grip on your heart? To get into that question a bit more, think, what things give me pleasure? Because that would suggest that's where your heart is. What things give you anxiety, keep you awake at night? This would suggest that's where your heart is. Do you need to declutter your heart? Your very heart, because your heart is taken up with things. Do I need to declutter my heart to make room for Jesus? Jesus goes on in that passage to talk about your eyes. Seems a bit of a strange diversion in the context, but basically he's saying, what do you see when you look at the world? Do you see stuff to accumulate? And when you look at other people, do you see people who have got more than you have? Or do you see a broken world? Do you see the rich who are dissatisfied? Do you see the poor who are struggling? Do you see, like Jesus, people who need the love of Jesus in their lives? What do you see when you look at the world? Because that is an indicator to you of which call you're following, the call of Jesus or the call of the world. And thirdly, the testing is so your heart, your eyes, and then he says, look at your hands. Who are you serving with those hands? What are you putting your effort into? Jesus says you cannot serve both God and stuff, but how much of your energy goes in to serving stuff, accumulating it, looking after it, nurturing it, protecting it? How much of your energy goes into stuff? Is it God or stuff who is your master? Joshua said to the people of Israel, choose this day whom you will serve. And Jesus puts two alternative gods in front of us. He says, choose which one you'll serve. Will it be God? Will it be stuff? At this point, I'd invite a response. I'd invite you to stand, if you wouldn't mind, if you feel able. If folk are happy with it, we will sing a song in a few moments if you don't feel I've taken too much of your time. But before we do that, I just invite you, just open your hands in front of you and just picture in your hands your most valued possession. I don't know what that is. I'm not even going to go there. I don't know. Maybe your phone. Maybe your bank statement. Maybe your car keys. Maybe your engagement ring. Maybe your armchair. Maybe your favourite mug. I don't know what it is. I don't know. Picture it in your hands. I wonder, what is the natural response of those hands now? Is it to grasp and hold it to yourself? Or is it to release it? Do you own it? Or does it own you? What effect does it have on your heart? Are you thinking of the pleasure that that thing gives you or the anxiety that it causes you? Does it have a grip on your heart? Does it have an effect on your eyes? Do you look at it and you think, yeah, that's mine? Or are you looking around and thinking, oh, but there's a better one that I could have? Do you see people who don't have what you've got right there in your hands? How do you feel about that? As you look at it, do you think of all the effort that you're putting into kind of keeping it in the condition that it's in and looking after it and hanging on to it? Does it have an effect on your hands? Ask yourself, why has God given me this? Why has he allowed me to have this? Maybe he hasn't given it to me. Maybe he's just lent it to me. It's not mine, is it? It's his. Why has he allowed me to have it? How does he want me to use it? Have I bought into the call of the world and I'm grasping it, I'm hanging on to it, and I'm saying, I want more, I want more, I want more? Am I saying, Lord, I want treasure in heaven. I don't want to hang on to treasure on earth. It's worth nothing. What would it look like in my life to lay that stuff down and to follow with a single heart the call of Jesus? If that sounds difficult, remember Jesus says, my yoke is easy. My burden is light. This stuff only causes pain and distress and dissatisfaction and anxiety. And Jesus says, I'm inviting you to an abundant life, a joyful life of carefree unconcern for possessions. Amen.